Welcome to Too Late to Die Young with me, Nina Mishkoff. Each week I talk to a celebrated guest who, like me, has been around for a while and is still going strong. Today my guest is comedian, writer and traveller Michael Palin, who found fame decades ago with Monty Python and then became our trusted TV travelling companion around the world. In 1982, he defined the meaning of life for Python as nothing very special, try to be nice to people, avoid eating fat, every now and then get some walking in, and try to live in harmony with people of all creeds and nations. So has he lived his life that way? I met him at his home in North London to find out. And we talked about celebrating his 75th birthday in North Korea, how having to wear specs in his 40s made him feel old, his wife Helen, and his recent good news from the palace. Michael Palin, or rather Sir Michael Palin, I mean, do I have to curtsy for a start?
You can curtsy any time, and I will curtsy back to you. That's all a bit of nonsense, that stuff. But it was very nice to be made Sir Michael, especially because it was for work and travel and understanding other countries and foreign relations and all that, which to help set an example for people to travel and travel well and learn about the world, I'm all for that.
What do the other Pythons think about it?
I have had some very, very nice, apparently completely sarcasm-free emails from all the Pythons. My favourite was from Terry Gilliam, who said, "Glad to hear you've been knitted." Just in time for the cold weather. I thought that's perfect. I've noticed a thing as you get older, that people are quite respectful. It's not an obvious thing, but people give you a slightly so easier ride once you've got to 75. I mean, they either ignore you totally, or they'll say, "Oh, God, he's 75, and he can still stand up. And you used to do that Python stuff." Yes, that's right. So you get a certain amount of respect, which I'm never very comfortable with. I don't think respect is what I want, really.
Why don't you want respect?
No, I mean, it's lovely to be liked and admired for what you've done. Respect is a certain element of a sort of you are better than them, which I've never ever really been able to convince myself that I am. I think everybody's got potential in them. And we should less creepy-crawly and more sort of get on with it and do your thing. But I don't want to be respected particularly. I want people to enjoy what I've done. Don't mind being even admired. But the main thing is that everybody has their own thing to do.
You mentioned the age of 75, and in fact you had your 75th birthday when you were filming your travel documentary on North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, it was the most bizarre and wonderful place to have a 75th birthday. Somehow you think in your mind, you'd be lucky to get 75 anyway. You do have your birthday, you'll be sitting by the fire with your family around you, someone offering you a drink, and can I get this? And, you know, and, oh, look, here's Uncle John, he's coming, all that sort of stuff. To be in a field in North Korea, attempting to do a sequence of planting whatever it was we were planting, whatever crop we were planting, but just totally unreal. It's like a dream. But that's what I was doing. That's where I was on my 75th birthday with a farmer in a field in North Korea, helping in the field. The idea was that Michael would help and that he'd be able to understand what it's like out there, which is a very sort of unautomated world. You know, everything's done by hand. And so I was very good. I thought I did a lot of good work. At the end, they said to the farmer, you know, what was it like? And she sort of expostulated in Korean, and it was translated as, "He's absolutely useless." So that was nice, to be found on your birthday, after 75 years on this planet, you were officially completely useless. I thought it was somehow very Pythonic.
I remember watching it, and I think she said you were unnecessary.
Actually, that's true. That's what came out when we did the retake. But unnecessary is also a very nice thing to know when you're 75. Yes, I wasn't quite sure what their attitude was to age. Respect, certainly. They were back to respect again. I think 75 in North Korea is probably, in fact, I know, that's quite old. The life expectancy there is much, much lower than here. And they will stop work about 60. But I think it's also, it takes people by surprise that someone of that age is doing what they're doing. I think they were quite surprised, for a start, that I was in North Korea, that I was working with a film crew, that I was getting up each morning and doing 10 hours filming each day. They couldn't really understand that because nobody in North Korea works at the age of 75. Wow, you know, this is something extraordinary.
Well, that's almost the whole point of this podcast, which I called Too Late to Die Young. It's for baby boomers, kind of people like me who've lived a bit but are still keeping going. I wondered what you thought when you heard the title, how it related to you, Too Late to Die Young.
Good title. Very clever, that. I have a mixed feeling about age. I can't really take it in that I am in my mid-70s. Well, the way I do that, sometimes I think back to what would I have thought when I was in my mid-20s of someone who was in their mid-70s. And I probably would have thought, well, that's, you know, that's towards the end. They're lucky to be alive, sort of thing. And so I have to kind of think back to that and realise that I've reached the age of 75 without feeling in any shape or form like someone of 75, mentally, certainly, physically. I think I'm a little bit slower, perhaps, than I used to be. But I'm still fairly fit and probably fitter and certainly look after myself better than when I was in my mid-20s. So it's this odd disconnect between the number and the feeling that goes with it. Well, I try really not to think about it, but I do think about it because my friends are all ageing as well. Now, that's a very important thing. It's what your friends are doing, their attitudes and all that. I'm really lucky that I've got a group of friends who, like me, have largely been freelance. They have chosen what they wanted to do. A lot of them are writers still there or actors, so they've still got, you know, there's still work for them to do. It's not a world like my father's world, where people at the age of 65 were retired. That's the end of your useful life, like the lady in North Korea. They're almost, you're useless after that. You retire. And then you look around for something to do when you're surplus to requirements. And I've never felt I've surplus to requirements. It's up to me. There are plenty of people out there I could work with, the people I can talk to, all of my own age who are all doing things. And I think that's really, really important, that you have a group of people around you who really don't appear to have aged. You know, I mean, I can sort of talk to people on the phone, ring people up, go out to dinner with people. We laugh just about the same sort of things we did when we were in our 20s or 30s. And the other thing is, which I wasn't quite prepared for, is that a lot of anxieties sort of disappear. You get to a certain age, you think, well, I am that age. If I die next year, that would probably be, you know, average. You haven't got a lot of years in which you're forced to compete for your place on this planet. You've established where you are. You've established your place. You've done most of what you want to do, and which is all rather a relief. And I think if this kind of a level of anxiety is reduced, it actually makes you feel happier and more content, and therefore you probably will live longer. So, but I do occasionally think, you know, 10 years' time, you know, they're talking, all these great government projects are all been, oh, it's all going to happen in 10 years' time. You know, we'll have driverless cars and we'll have HS2 and all that sort of thing. And I think, well, I won't see that. And then I think, well, I'm going to be 85. You know, people live beyond 85. I see David Attenborough in the distance there, 93, still sort of clambering over plateaus and standing in the middle of swamps doing pieces to camera. And that's 93. The Queen, you know, talking to people every single day. What do you do? Oh, that's most interesting.
She still wears her high heels. I mean, they're not stilettos, yeah, but she's there in her high heels.
I know, which is something, you know, David Attenborough doesn't have to worry about, of course.
Sorry.
Are you all right?
The image of David Attenborough in high heels is just, yeah, it's just a bit too much for me. Looking at your life from the outside, people will imagine this sort of seamless rise via Monty Python into sort of other television, films, etc. Angst-free, that you've somehow... Yeah. It's not that?
Absolutely not at all. I mean, without angst, you can't do anything. Everything from sort of leaving university, what am I going to do now? My father wants me to go into a respectable job. I want to do some acting and comedy writing. That was a, you know, real battle at that time to prove that I could make some money from doing what I wanted to do, which was acting and writing. Monty Python was never financially very successful. It was a show which we did. It was experimental. We didn't get immediate recognition. We certainly didn't get any money out of it until it had been sold to America many years later. So everything was a little bit of a battle. Nothing happened the way it feels from looking back on it. You know what I mean? Looking back, it all seems seamless. Oh, yes, you did this and that led to that. But I mean, for instance, going from Monty Python to Ripping Yarns, very difficult transition. Monty Python had by that time become very popular. The group had broken up. What do we do next? Terry and myself do something called Ripping Yarns, which was by no means a certain success at all. And that was fraught with difficulty. How do we write it together? Do we act in it together and all that sort of thing? So you go on then to the films I made during the 80s, from like The Missionary and all that, my own film written, all that. And you're in the difficult world of film distribution, where you can make the best film in the world, and if it doesn't get distributed, enormous amount of time has been wasted. And then Around the World in 80 Days, which was the most difficult thing to get my head around to start with.
Why was that?
Well, I mean, I knew I wanted to go around the world. That was fine. But then you realise it's not just going around the world. The BBC wants 6 hours of television out of this. And you are the one person who has got to deliver. You've got a crew there and they're going to be with you all the time. You don't know where you're exactly going, who you're going to meet. You know, how are you going to sort of flesh out these programmes? What's going to be in them? What's going to be your attitude? Do you play it as a reporter? Do you play it as an actor? Or do you just play it as yourself? In the end, I played it as myself. And the things that went wrong proved to be the things that actually appealed to people. They said, well, that's the common man travelling. But it wasn't like that when I set out. I was full of anxiety about it.
People would be astounded by that, watching it. It just seemed so natural. And I think people just loved being in your company, both physically, the people that you were meeting, and people watching it who went along on these journeys with you. From the outside, it would appear just like breathing to you.
That's when it worked, when it was natural, when I was really comfortable. But this is not what... You're not sort of hired to just, Michael, just go and stand in front of a camera and be yourself. You know, it's an idea, it's a lot of money has gone into it, you've got a crew, you've got a schedule, you've got to do it in 80 days. That all these elements come into it to make you feel anything but comfortable and relaxed. You know, you're working to a goal, it's the BBC, they're putting on BBC One, it's got to work. If you don't get back within 80 days, it's not going to be a bit of a disaster. So you've got to try and somehow deal with all that and get it back to the point where you feel really comfortable. And that's one thing I've sort of learnt over the years, is that actually the more relaxed everyone can be when making a programme, the better. You know, some people, I think, believe that it has to be difficult, it has to be hard, and we've got to push this and we've got to do that, and it's got to be something we've never done before. Let's just do it. Do it and do it well and enjoy doing it. And that's, I've been very, very lucky, because I've worked with generally small groups of people, from Python round to the team who went round the world with me, and who've been terrific and great support, and we enjoy ourselves. So we do work hard, but we try to reduce the level of a sort of expectation, stress and demand that is always hanging around there.
You mentioned your father retiring at 65 and wanting to do something other with your life than what he had thought you would do. I mean, how pivotal was that?
Well, doing something other than my father did, that was tricky, because he, you know, I was his only son, and son and heir, as it were, and he wanted me to go through the benefits of education that he had, which was public school, university. He'd been to Cambridge and all that. But in his case, it hadn't worked out. He'd become an engineer, hadn't been terribly successful. The start of his working life coincided with the Great Depression in the 30s and all that. So I can see, looking back now, that there'd been real frustrations, and the way he dealt with it was by playing by the rules, wearing a suit in the morning, going to the office, sitting in all these committee meetings with these people who, you know, and he had a stammer as well, which can't have helped. So I think he took a very formal pathway and probably would have been much happier. And I know this actually from what I've heard from my mum, that he would have been much happier being a church organist or a bell ringer. That's the sort of thing he really loved. But of course, his parents before him, that generation, you can't do that. You've got to do something professional. You've got to go into a profession. And he wanted me to go into a profession. He just didn't know which profession I wanted to go into. And I was just very, very fortunate to grow up and come to my teens in the 1960s, when attitudes were really changing. After the war, everything was very strict. My parents had been through two world wars and a major depression. And, you know, they just wanted to hang on to what they got. Let's not change anything, please. You know, let's just try and cope, get things back to normal again. Whereas by the 50s and 60s, we all had a bit more money, a bit more ideas in the air. There was flair in fashion, in music. Everyone was sort of wanting to do something different. David Frost did That Was the Week That Was, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and they'd done Beyond the Fringe, that sort of sent up prime ministers and all that. Things were changing very, very rapidly. And so I was very, very fortunate to come at a time where there was a potential to do something different. I mean, it wasn't easy. I couldn't say to my dad, I'm just going to be a scriptwriter, that's it, you know. I just had to do it through the back door and pretend I was working for the BBC. That was all right.
That would sound okay to your father, the BBC.
Yes, I mean, the fact that I was dressing up as a woman, you know, standing on one leg and hitting people with a rubber hammer, that was neither here nor there. I was still working for the BBC. It was being made by the BBC, so that put me on the same level, in his mind, as Richard Dimbleby or someone like that.
So that was okay, and you got away with it, if you like.
Yes, I got away with it because, again, as I say, things had changed so much. I was born and brought up in Sheffield. I went to Oxford, met friends, left Sheffield, was able to go to London. Things were happening in London. I could, you know, scrabble together some money to live in digs in London, all that. I had met at university people who I knew I liked and who had similar instincts like myself, Terry Jones, Robert Hewson, people who weren't going to do what their dads had done, weren't going to be bank managers. Weren't quite sure what else they were going to do, but they weren't going to do that. And we just hung on. We hung on at the BBC, and via various strokes of good fortune. For instance, I mean, David Frost putting together a show called The Frost Report. It was hugely important. That was 1966. That employed an enormous number of young writers, plus the older writers as well. So it was a real mixture. A new cast, your Cleese and the two Ronnies. No one had seen them before. And David and his producer, Jimmy Gilbert, very, very good at bringing in people like ourselves. Very little money, but we were working with people who were writers, were working comedy writers, and they were writing very good sketches for a programme that was very, very successful. So we were sort of caught up in the energy of that programme. But the only way I could survive was by taking a part in a TV pop show, which was recorded in Bristol for TWW, Television Wales and the West, and it was called Now! Exclamation mark. And that was a very hip title then, you know. It wasn't just about songs and about music, it was about fashion, and it was about, you know, the news and a bit of politics and all that. I could do a sort of Harold Wilson impersonation and all that, so they liked that. And for about a year, I was principal presenter on Now, and that made me enough money on one day a week to survive and to work with Terry Jones on scripts at the BBC.
I had no idea about you were in a programme with an exclamation mark at the end of it. That was obviously really, really hip and on trend.
It was for a little bit, yes. We all hoped it would be very, very hip and on trend. And the first show, our star guest was Tom Jones, who was unknown really at the time. It's not unusual because I think he'd taken over from PJ Proby on a tour, because PJ Proby had split his trousers or something.
I remember that. Well, who could forget that?
So we had Tom then. It all seemed rather wonderful. But then, you know, it was an ITV show that was only shown in that one region. It didn't have enough money to get the really a series of good acts together, like Ready Steady Go or Top of the Pops and all that. So we would get one act, like The Small Faces, but we'd also have to have three other acts owned by the Small Faces management, who were never going to do anything at all and they were really sort of bad. So now became then rather quickly.
When you look back, how amazed would your father have been by how your life and your career has progressed and shaped?
I mean, he'd be absolutely delighted, be over the moon, I think, because he didn't quite get Python. He had Parkinson's, and so was not terribly well at the time, and found Python quite extraordinary, didn't really get it. But I think if he'd lived long enough to see me do the travel show, something like that, he would have loved those. He would have thought that was marvellous, you know. And I think he would have felt in the end that, although when I was just at university and going and doing television at the very beginning there, he wasn't sure what I was doing. I was very, very nervous about me getting into any theatrical activity of any kind. My sister had been keen on the theatre, and it hadn't worked out for her, and she'd had to come back, and she made no money and all that. But you know, if you love the theatre, if you want to act, it's something you want to do, whatever. And people say you can't, you say, well, I'm going to be the judge of that. But it hadn't worked out for her. He didn't want me to get into that same situation. And yet now, you know, to see me, if he'd seen me doing something like Vanity Fair or, you know, GBH or some of the acting roles I've done, I think he would have been... He just said, oh, well, you know, he's got paid. What's wrong with the theatre? He's getting paid. He hasn't come back to me for money.
I just want to pause here while I say thank you to our sponsors. And I'm happy to tell you about a product that I actually use myself. In fact, I've taken Imodene skincare supplements since they were launched here in the UK in 1991. That's a long time. I was in my mid-40s and I had a column in You magazine testing out beauty products. So when Imodene arrived, I was curious. I mean, it wasn't a moisturiser or anything you used on the skin, but pills especially formulated for the skin, for radiance from within, they said. Well, I was a bit sceptical, like you would be, but took the pills every day for 3 months and was photographed barefaced before and after. Well, very brave, frankly. I genuinely felt you could see a difference, a sort of, a radiance, softer lines. Imodene supplied me with the product for a year afterwards, very nice people, but I've bought it myself since. Recently, I had my skin density and collagen levels tested in-store in Boots with the Imodene ultrasound scanning system. It's free, and they test it on your wrist rather than on your face, and the results were excellent. My collagen levels were those of somebody much younger. People seem genuinely surprised when they hear my age, and I am, I have to say, when I look in the mirror. So I'm sticking with Imodene. Too Late to Die Young with me, Nina Mishkoff. Today, my guest is comedian, writer and traveller, Michael Palin. When you look back, what are you most proud of?
Proud of is a difficult thing to sort of quantify. I really am pleased that we found a way of travelling and recording the world and dealing with the world that has obviously encouraged an awful lot of people to see the world differently, to be less frightened of the world, to be more open to going to places, to realise that there are other ways than to travelling than in big tour groups. There are places to find out, there are people to meet. There's an awful lot you can learn from travelling, and you shouldn't be frightened of going out there. So I'm quite proud that I overcame what was my own fear of travelling. It was, I don't speak the language, I don't know the culture of these people, I'm going to make a complete fool of myself. Because of the structure of Around the World in 80 Days, because of the fact that we were filming all the time, in the end, I just ended up reacting the way I felt was genuine at the time. And to be able to do that and to have enabled people to overcome perhaps their own fear and apprehension about the rest of the world. Now, I'm sort of proud of that, yes. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm proud, because proud suggests that you've kind of, like Michelangelo, you've done the Sistine Chapel, you know, got it all right. Look, oh, God, that's really nice, that bit there. It's just, you know, it's just me doing my thing. And I'm really fortunate in my life that I've been able to do all that. I mean, Monty Python, we did so much. And I was in my 20s when we did those Python shows, 45 TV shows. When we were dressing up, we were playing sort of 8, 9, 10 different characters every half hour. You were dressing up in absolutely everything. You were doing the most ridiculous things. I remember doing a sketch with John where we had one moustache between us. And so as soon as one person finished speaking, they'd take the moustache off and stick it on the other person, who would then do their speech. These are really wacky, wonderful things to do. And I'm really glad that I got those out of my system fairly early on.
Because there's the kind of dichotomy between the sort of academic, cultured man and the sort of the wonderfully silly side. There's this kind of introverted side and the extrovert side, and they kind of sit together.
I've always thought of myself, actually, as a kind of introverted extrovert or an extroverted introvert, because I was always quite shy at school. I wasn't the first person to put their hand up and want to talk about this. And I still am in a certain way. I don't see myself as sort of part of... There's a kind of sort of showbiz world where people are always around. They're going to all the openings and they're talking about this and they're giving their opinions on that. I've never been very comfortable with that. I've always said, well, I just want to do what I can do. But I know that also there's a great exhibitionist in me, and I love performing and I love going in front of an audience. I mean, maybe that happens to a lot of people. I know a lot of actors who are quite shy people. They get on stage and wonderful, they absolutely blossom, whereas people who are terribly extrovert get on stage, they're just being them, you know, as they are normally, you know, objectionable.
Michael,
no name, no factor.
Oh, go on. We sometimes bump into each other because I live not far around the corner and I'm always staggering back from the gym looking like the wreck of the Hesperus, and you are looking very urbane and in a beautiful coat going to the tube somewhere. The last time we actually met was when you published your last section of your diaries.
Yes.
I'm wondering, because you've kept a diary every day since, was it 1969, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, not actually every day. There have been gaps, but I do try and keep it regularly. Yes.
And you write in a particular way? You've the same notebooks?
I write by hand. I've always written longhand. I keep it up. It's become like a habit now in the morning. It's a bit like sort of cleaning my teeth, you know, just write the events of the day before. It's as simple as that. There are murky periods that I can't absolutely recall, but the act of keeping a diary is sort of in lieu of memory. It is creates the memory there. And sometimes I can't think what I've done for an entire year. And I go and look at the diary and I realise, oh, God, yeah, I was making that series then, or I was writing this or that.
And you write only on the right-hand page?
What are you trying to make me out?
No, I just think it's fascinating because you showed me when I met you that you write, beautiful handwriting, by the way, writing only on the right page, and then when you get to the end, you turn over and you come back the other way.
Nina, I've not showed many people this. And we are having to share something now. If you promise this will not go out to anybody else, I do write on the right-hand page. Absolutely. And then I turn the notebook over and go on the other side all the way back. So every page is covered. Thank you very much. I think that's enough we need to say.
Well, I can now confess to you that I have a pink notebook that I carry with me, and I write on the right-hand page, but then I go and write on the left-hand page, but I write on the right-hand page first.
We are fellow wrecks of the Hesperus.
No, in that last collection, you did write about a few deaths. I mean, there was obviously Graham Chapman, there was your...
Oh, yes. Well, Graham Chapman and my mother and a very good friend of mine, American guy, who died far too young, called Al Levinson, all died within a sort of period of about 3 months. And that was very hard to deal with.
You know, at our age of life, we've obviously experienced death of our parents and many other people. How did that leave you?
I mean, in most cases, I suppose it's a question of how and when somebody dies. You know, I mean, if they die of old age, like my mother did, I was actually quite glad when she eventually died because she was very unhappy in the last sort of 2 or 3 months of her life. You could tell that she was in pain and it wasn't comfortable, and she was 86 years old. You know, when my sister died and committed suicide, that's a more difficult thing to get your head around because you think of all the things she could have done and the waste there. So it really depends on the circumstances. And with Graham Chapman, it was a terrific loss because Graham was only 48. And, dear old Gray had you know, worked himself quite hard. He drank a lot. Used to smoke and all that. And he'd given all that up, you know, and it was just approaching a really wonderful sort of middle age where he was wise and funny and loving. And then, you know, it suddenly catches up with him, you know, the past catches up. So that was very hard to deal with.
I once met Graham at a party at the Rainbow Theatre, I think the reopening of the Rainbow, I think it was, and there was a massive people, and he sort of pitched up beside me, and he said to me, "Do you have a drink?" And I said, "No." He said, "Would you like some vodka?" And I went, "I'd love some vodka." And he somehow got a flunky, and he ended up holding towards me a tray of about 20 shot glasses of vodka. I don't know why. I have no idea why. I mean, I'd never met him before. I think we drank quite a few of them.
Yeah, well, you obviously hit it off. There was obviously something in your eyes there, which you could only be satisfied with 20 shot glasses. But that was Graham in his, sadly, his some would say his heyday. In fact, it was kind of a terrible time because he nearly drank himself to death. But, I mean, some of the most wonderful moments I can remember with Graham after he'd had a drink or two. He was a genuinely eccentric man. When we were filming Monty Python, we were all in this one hotel miles away from anywhere, and Graham had a thing about names, and the name Betty Marsden, and Betty Marsden was a sort of radio star of the time. He loved that name, and he'd come to bed always later than anybody else because he'd been at the bar till about 1 o'clock, and you'd hear him going down the corridor saying, "Betty Marsden, Betty Marsden, hello, Betty Marsden, I'm available, I'm going to bed alone." Oh, God. And this went on after about 4 nights. Just said, "Gray, please, do you mind not shouting Betty Marsden at night? Because we're all trying to get a bit of a sleep." And the next night there was absolutely nothing at all, but in the morning I found a little envelope slipped under my door, and I opened it up, and there written on a piece of paper was Betty Marsden. You know, that's what Graham was like. Lovely.
Wonderful. You mentioned your sister taking her own life. I mean, that must have been horrendous. I mean, how old was she?
She was early 50s, and she'd suffered from a depression, very deep depression. So it wasn't a total surprise. It was still shocking, but, you know, what I left me with was just desperately trying to understand how depression could be that deep, you know, because she was married happily, 3 very lovely children, all been very successful. She was funny, and she was attractive, and, you know, she had everything going for her, and that's so, and yet still there was something there so dark and so sort of intense and fierce that it sort of dragged her down, and that I can't understand.
That must have been very hard to process, that, in some ways.
Of course it was hard to deal with, because you start looking at, you know, whether you could in any way have prevented it. And she used to come and see us and all that. And in fact, she played tennis with my wife the day before she killed herself, you know. So it was, you kept thinking, could we have just said something at a certain time that would have stopped her doing this? And I think the answer is absolutely not.
That's very sad, isn't it?
It's a disease, which I now realise. Depression like that is a physical disease, and anyone who thinks it isn't and says, "Oh, it's just pull yourself together," that's not the way it is. So it's made me think a lot about things like that and about people and how people deal with their problems.
I think you and I are both very lucky. We're in reasonable nick. You still run on the heath, I think, and I go to the gym every day, and you lope around the area and on television.
Lope. Do I lope? I like to lope. I like the idea of loping.
Yeah, I think you...
Limping, actually, I would have said.
No, you have a sort of elegant lope, I feel. Have a look next time you're on.
I like talking to you, Nina. You're lovely. Elegant lope, I like that.
Oh, I'm glad, but that's just the phrase that sprang to mind.
Yeah, no, I remember that.
Good.
Step over the bathroom mat next time. Oh, bloody, I've loped again. Yeah, I've lost me lope.
you've just the other day had an operation on your shoulder. I understand, but basically, yeah. you are well and healthy.
I think so. Yes, I always think, well, you're as good as you are as you wake up and each morning. You know, glad to be alive each morning. But yeah, I'm very, very aware of how glad I am to be wake up in the morning, be able to get to the mirror, look myself in the mirror, a shave without slitting my throat, and then lope downstairs without falling over and banging my head.
I'm pathetically proud of the fact that I don't wear specs yet. And somebody said to me, well, if you're not wearing specs by 72, you probably won't have to wear them. See, the thing is, if I had to get a pair of specs, I think then I'd go through a terrible crisis about age. I had a crisis when I was 40, turned 40. The 70th birthday was not good either. Once that was over, it was fine. But if I think I suddenly had to wear specs, I'd think, Christ, you are getting old.
I know exactly what you mean. And that's one of those moments when I definitely felt I'm on the downward slope. I was in my late 40s, as happens to most people, apart from superhumans like yourself, that I was in a hotel. I remember I was with my daughter. We'd gone travelling in Norwich or somewhere like that. And next morning I said, I couldn't read in bed last night. The current in this hotel, it's so dim, isn't it? She said, what? Well, the lights are so dim, I couldn't see a thing in this book. She said, no, the lights are absolutely fine. Then I realised, of course, the eyesight was beginning to need correction. And the other thing was when we use A to Z all before, sat-nav and all that. They used to have a great big A to Z. And I remember going to someone's house in Notting Hill. I didn't know where I was. I had to stop. I couldn't see the A to Z at all, apart from putting the headlights on for getting out of the car, crouching by the headlights and looking at the A to Z to see where somebody lived. I thought, this is it, things are going wrong. And that was definitely a moment of ageing. Beyond that, I'm not sure really, but on the whole, I've not had anything quite as cruel as the eyesight problem.
As I say, the thing is, we're both sort of healthy, but then of course it must be really awful to live and just dwindle away. I mean, I'm thinking of Terry Jones. When did you first realise that he was not well?
You talk about dying young. I mean, all of us have lived a life and had a good life, and Terry had done a lot, but still had the potential to do a lot more. But I noticed when we were doing the O2 shows, the 10 Python farewell shows, that Terry was, for the first time ever, having trouble remembering lines. I mean, he never had any problem with that at all. He was absolutely spot on. And I knew then that something was changing a bit. And that was, that was 4 years ago.
Has it been a kind of gradual descent? Does he still recognise you, or do you still see him?
I do still see him. I think it's very important to go and see him. I think there's less awareness each time. He withdraws into himself. The problem with Terry's particular kind of frontotemporal dementia, I think it's called, is that he lost the power of speech, for somebody whom words were so important. So it means that you can't really have a conversation with him. But I still talk to him, and I can see him react sometimes. Other times he won't, he'll just drift off. And I think it's just this form of dementia. You're slowly retreating, really. That's what the mind's doing. It's slowly closing down. So I think all the more important to go and see him and to be recognised by Terry, see him just look and smile as he sees you. That's terrific. That means an enormous amount. We don't talk. I talk. He doesn't talk much. But just, as I say, that moment of recognition, or a hand on my arm or something like that, and a little squeeze, which he sometimes does, that's important. But I suppose things like that will become fewer and fewer instances, which is sad. It's a puzzle. I mean, really, what happens to the mind and mental illness of any kind is really so complex and so extraordinary and so, so difficult for us all to come to terms with. We all know when our mind goes and does some strange thing. I forget the most obvious things, and that comes with age and all that. But you know that up there, things aren't always just going to be absolutely smooth, and it's just going to be something in your brain, a few sort of cells fuse together, and then you're deprived of everything you really enjoy. So trying to kind of work out what it means to people who are undergoing dementia is really difficult, and I think nobody really knows.
Your marriage to Helen and your relationship with Helen has been a real major part of your life. I mean, I think, is it 60 years this year since you met?
Yeah, I think it probably is. We met, I mean, I was 16 when I first met her on holiday, yeah, so, and I'm now 75, so do the math, as they say. Yeah, that's really important. I mean, we're like a couple of old pals, really, now. We've been together for so long and known so much and known so much about each other. And yet still don't know everything. We've still got some secrets.
You're kidding. Have you still got secrets, do you think?
I'm not telling you. It's between me and Lady Palin.
Oh, of course she's Lady Palin. How does Helen feel about Lady Palin?
She doesn't speak to me now. It's honestly, unless I'm wearing the right kind of ermine and on one of those little kneelers, you know, just to get an audience is enough.
Because, as I say, Helen has had no interest really in doing the travelling that you've done, so she's been a great sort of counterpoint to you, really.
Yes, I mean she's terrifically sort of feet on the ground and always has been, is much more practical than I am, and sees practical solutions and gets quite irritated when I get emotional about things that won't unscrew and tops that won't come off pots and things like that. I have a go at the makers, the people, you know, whatever the thing is that I'm trying to work. How can they put you peas that you can't open, you know, all that sort of thing. So she's very good at sort of steadying me. And we just get on very well, largely because we have a similar sense of humour. And that's the one thing I remember when we first met. On the beach all that time ago, I could make her laugh and she could make me laugh, and that was quite important, really. That was the first sign of attraction.
I remember, because there was you made a drama out of it, didn't you? And it was, I can vaguely remember a scene on the beach.
Yes.
It was just really sweet and funny and romantic.
It was called East of Ipswich. It was something which I am proud of, actually. I wrote it, I wasn't in it. And it was really a sort of reminiscence of what it was like going on a holiday with your parents when you were, you know, just in adolescent years. And so, you know, meeting girls for the first time away from home and all that sort of stuff. So it's as much about one's relationship to one's parents, actually, as it was about one's relationship to the girls you met. I just remember that it was most brilliantly cast and it was definitely something that I was able to explore, my relationship to my parents and the awful embarrassment of being with your parents when you're a teenager and really wanting to sort of break loose and listen to rock and roll music and all that. Rock and what, dear? Rock and roll. Rocky bit. Oh, it's, don't worry, Dad. It's all.
No Bo Diddley?
I don't know any Bo Diddley, no. Was it? Do you take it? Do you rub it on? No, it's a man, he's a singer.
How will you cope with which one is going to go first? That's the awful thing when you've been with somebody you love so much for such a long period of time. What do you do?
Well, I do sometimes think about it, and I'm sure Helen does too. And you just get on with life, really. I you know, it would be extremely hard just to deal with the absence of someone you've known for so long. So much of the context of your life would sort of all be gone. But, you know, we've got family, we've got the children, they've all shared this, you know, continuity, things will go on.
So, a good life, Michael Palin?
Yes, a very good life, I think. I mean, I'm always wary of those people who answer questionnaires, how would you rate your life out of 10? And people say 10. I said, come on, 10? You must be joking. Have you, ever had a cold? No. So, I would always say I'm around 7. Which I think is about fair enough. There's good times and bad times. But I think that's part of life. I really do. I think I don't think there's any one sort of level at which everything you're content all the time. I think the contentment comes after the effort. The happiness and the satisfaction comes after doubt and anxiety. They're all there together and they will be part of my life. And I think you've got to be aware of both sides and be aware that... those are the different elements that make a good life.
Finally, what is the meaning of life, Michael Palin, and has it changed over the years since you wrote your memorable thesis on it?
I would say the meaning of life is probably yes.
Michael Palin, exactly as you imagine him to be, having lived his life, as he predicted, all those Python years ago. You've been listening to Too Late to Die Young with me, Nina Mishkoff. Production was by Lucy Ditchmont for Audioboom. My thanks to our sponsors, Imadine, to the H Club in London for recording facilities, and to Edwin Pearson for the music. If you like the show, subscribe, like it, or just tell someone about it. Old school.